Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Pellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Well, welcome back to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch's Murders, Money, and Mystery. We are here for a special episode to talk about a development that has just come up in the last 24 hours that we've been made aware of. Roll the clip.
When jurors receive private communications outside the confines of a public courtroom, the Sixth Amendment is violated and numerous other constitutional rights are violated. And that's not Jim Griffin on the law. That is the law of the land. And I want to quote from a decision from the South Carolina Court of Appeals, which is behind me, and states this: where there is a private communication of a court official to members of the jury, an occurrence which cannot be tolerated if the sanctity of the jury system is to be maintained, a new trial must be granted unless it clearly appears that the subject matter of the communication was harmless and could not have affected the verdict. What we had filed today, supported by sworn testimony of jurors, is that the clerk of court had improper private communications with the jurors, and the subject matter of those communications was the credibility of the defense that the Murdoch legal defense team put up, and it was the believability of the defendant's own testimony.
I'm Ann Emerson. I'm joined today by our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, former Attorney General of South Carolina, and our executive producer, Drew Tripp. We're here to try and break some of this new bombshell information down that we just received in the last 24 hours about where the defense attorneys for Alec Murdoch are looking for a new trial. What did you think when you got that call, Charlie?
By the way, great to be back. How long has it been?
Months.
Months. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We took a little month.
But this is. But I think this occasion is a worthy one to start back in, right? Because bombshell, I think, is the word to use. The allegation is that the elected clerk of court tampered with the Murdoch jury, and need I say more? I mean, just an explosive bombshell allegation by the defense that it's not just lawyer talk, though, right? I mean, they've got affidavits from jurors that say this. And so I think that's why this is a very serious charge and serious matter.
So you use the word tampering. Is there a legal distinction for what constitutes tampering? Is it definitely tampering that we're dealing with it as far as the legal definition in the state of South Carolina?
Great question. I actually looked it up because I was curious. I've never prosecuted a tampering case with a jury before, and there is a statute for tampering with a jury, but it involves, in South Carolina, the payment of money, which there's no allegation of that. I do think I'm not saying that she's guilty of this, but the step fast-forwarding, on the state level, the possible charge that comes to mind is what would be called misconduct in public office. That would be the more appropriate charge. On the federal level, they've got federal statutes. Of course, the defense has asked for a federal investigation. I don't know where that stands. I think they use the word tampering, though, to trigger these cases that the state, that the defense has cited. And they've cited cases from really all over, where they try to get that language in relative to improper contact with jurors.
Well, and I want to take it back a little bit. I want everyone to understand who we're talking about, because we kind of jumped into it like right off the bat as far as the charges mm-hmm. have been put forth, the accusations from the defense attorneys for Alec Murdaugh. This is centers around a character that we all know very well based on how much time we were in that courtroom, literally. Her name is Rebecca Hill. She is the county clerk of court for Colton County, mm-hmm. where the Alec Murdaugh double murder trial was held for 6 weeks. Her job was to be in there, to be corralling this jury, mm-hmm. to be going back and forth as they're entering and leaving. We heard from her extensively throughout the time, and she was always a presence. In mm-hmm. a very important role. Now, a very important role. She's also an elected official.
Yes.
And so here's where I'd like to start this. First off, and we'll get to why all of this started coming out and what role she played after this trial that we started learning all this new information. But talk to me about the role of the clerk of court. I think we need to understand, because I don't even know for real if every state has the same. So,
yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, I don't know how it would. Yeah, good point. I don't know how it would work in other states. In South Carolina, it's an elected public official, 46 counties, so we have 46 clerks of court. Mm-hmm. And I do know this, that the clerk of court is in effect in charge of the courthouse. If you want access to it, if you want to do certain things, you go through the clerk of court's office. And that was very evident, by the way Becky ran that trial. I thought she did a really good job in terms of organizing it. First day, I was really impressed with how they had badges ready for everybody, and the press was handled, and how you had access. And she did tell us, as I recall, that she got advice from other clerks of court in South Carolina. And some of them, in fact, showed up during the trial, and they were assisting her through the tremendous procedure that had to occur. I mean, it was a lot. And Colleton County is a rural county in South Carolina. I'm sure their budgets aren't as robust as the urban areas. And for her to have pulled it off, so to speak, as flawlessly as she did, of course, now we've got a big footnote on flawless, don't we?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, to your point, one of the duties of the clerk of court, one of the things under her umbrella, under her purview, is jury management.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
The clerk, jury selection, putting people in the pool, who gets summoned to the office. And typically, I know this happened in this case in particular, there's a very close working relationship with the clerk and the presiding judge, just on the logistics of things. And so she would be the go-to person. And it's typical where a clerk, and of course in the urban counties, typically the deputy clerks, they just have really close contact with jurors in terms of the logistics of it, be here at this certain time, if they have special needs. None of that is improper or unusual, just regular communications. What the defense, though, is alleging is very specific allegations of improper direct contact with jurors. And they also, I got thinking about this really today, one of the allegations here, you have to kind of deep dive on their motion, but they, with this Facebook business, they're positing that she affirmatively got involved with really fraud, in effect, mm-hmm. to get rid of a juror. Now that is an additional really serious allegation that they're making at this point in time.
Yes, it is. And we're going to deconstruct that a little bit. To Charlie's point about those allegations, I've made some notes here of what Alec Murdaugh's defense attorneys, Jim Griffin, Dick Arpootlian, what they're saying. And again, mm-hmm. these are based on what they have provided, sworn affidavits of three separate jurors who were part of the mm-hmm. Murdaugh jury pool. They've gotten statements from these individuals. They've interviewed them. They've taken down copious notes, gone through that whole vetting process, and they've presented it now to the State Court of Appeals, asking for the State Court of Appeals to put Alec's appeal on hold, basically, so that they can take these findings back to the circuit court and Judge Newman and potentially another judge mm-hmm. to overlook them and oversee them and determine whether or not a retrial is warranted. But this is Jim and Dick's interpretations and their synopsis of what these juror affidavits say. That, one, Becky Hill discussed the case with jurors before they began deliberations. That she tampered with the jury by advising them not to believe Alec Murdoch's testimony and other defense evidence. That she pressured jurors to reach a quick guilty verdict. That she invented a story, as Charlie just referenced, that she essentially invented a story about a Facebook post to get a juror removed who she believed was favorable to the defense, favorable to Murdoch. And they say Becky was motivated to do all of this by pursuit of personal fame and fortune and enrichment, trying to get a book deal, trying to get media appearances.
Which she did, which she got a book. She has a book out and has been...
Yeah, you might have some insight. I was really sort of puzzled as to the defense is saying that the reason these jurors came forward was because of this book. What's in the book that would get them going, so to speak?
Well, we've been going through that. Drew and I have been looking at that as well, as far as the information on what she was talking about. Now, I just reread. Drew, you just sent through some sort of notes from the book as well, and... in her book, she talks about these jurors in a very personal way.
Oh, was that it, maybe?
Well, I think that was part of it. And mm-hmm. I think it was also, you know, at least one of those jurors had very serious concerns about whether or not she thought he was Alec Murdoch, the mm-hmm. defendant, whether or not defendant Murdoch was guilty yet. Mm-hmm. So she was waiting until the closing arguments. She wanted to hear all of the statements, because she said that could be very persuasive mm-hmm. as far as how she went about it. And this is the same juror who was removed in the 11th hour of our...
Yes.
Right, during mm-hmm. the closing arguments. And mm-hmm. this was one of those jurors. But, you know... Not only very personal information mm-hmm. that was written in the book, not really relevant mm-hmm. to anything, right? In this, and you can give us a little bit more on that if you want to, Drew. But yeah, I mean, it was the problem that many people had referenced in this book was mm-hmm. that it was just kind of mm-hmm. gossipy, and that's where it rub these jurors wrong? Well, something did, because they wouldn't talk to these defense attorneys mm-hmm. until this book came out, according mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. This book was sort of the catalyst mm-hmm. to release all this information and for the jurors to go ahead and say, here's my sworn affidavit. We had a problem in
there. Wow. Talk about the law of unintended consequences.
Wow.
So to that point, I have an excerpt from Becky Hill's book that I'm going to read through some of it right now. And she has an entire chapter in her book dedicated to working with the jury during the Murdoch trial. And just to Ann's point about some of the stuff that maybe might have made the jurors uncomfortable, or that might have mm-hmm. motivated them to, like, hey, you know what, I don't appreciate that. And they finally answered the door knocks of what we heard yesterday. Jim Griffin, Dick Harpootlian say they traveled many miles through Colleton County after the trial, trying to get in touch with these jurors and get them to talk, because they were acting on what they were led, what they described as a quote-unquote whisper campaign that began immediately after the verdict, insinuating that something, mm-hmm. to quote Jim, untoward had happened in the jury room. Or I think that may have been Dick who said that this morning on mm-hmm. Good Morning America. But that was the impetus for it. They heard the Murdoch's attorney say they were of the belief from the very end of the trial that something not on the up and up had taken place in that jury room. And they spent all summer trying to track it down, and it was only after Becky's book came out that right. these jurors started coming forward and being willing to talk. But so what could be in that book that would cause them to do that? Just a few notes. She says one juror was... She describes it as the one juror was not so much focused on the trial as she was on the crowd, and was just constantly looking into the crowd and looking out at different people. Yeah. And apparently at one point caught someone trying to take a picture of the jury mm-hmm. and told on them. She said there was another juror who couldn't sit still and was constantly squeaking their chair during the trial and was causing a distraction. And then she gets into who she calls the egg lady. The egg lady is a woman who was removed in the 11th hour of the trial. She was a juror who was removed in the 11th hour of the trial. And much of what Alec Murdoch, much of what these juror affidavits and Murdoch's attorney's filings are about is centered on the egg lady, as she's called. And it goes in, it gives Becky's account of that. But before we jump into that, that is not so much as, even though it gets a lot of focus, the egg lady gets a lot of focus, it's really not, in the grand scheme of things, in my opinion, on reading this, it's really not the, it's the scandalous part of it. It's the, I guess you could say, the juicy part of it, but from a strictly legal standpoint and the what we're going after here, which is that, does Alec Murdoch deserve a new trial?
Mm-hmm.
What happened with the Facebook post and the egg lady, real briefly, essentially, the egg lady, there's a claim that was put forth that basically her ex-husband was saying things about her and the trial and the jury on a Facebook group, and he was talking out of his behind. Basically, he had no.
Is that a legal term?
Had no real clue. He was talking out of turn. Had no real clue what was going on. They'd been separated for a decade. He was just running his mouth, and that led to a Facebook post that drew the attention of the court, and it was part of the reason why she got called into the principal's office. It was not, if you read the filing from Jim and Dick, it was not why she was actually dismissed from the jury. She was dismissed from the jury because there were sworn affidavits from two people in the city of Walterboro who claimed that she was talking about the case in public. Essentially, she was the juror, egg lady, as they call her, juror number, if you'll give me one moment. I think it was juror 785.
Yeah.
Juror number 785. I apologize. I keep putting my camera away or my microphone away from my face. But juror 785 was a landlord and essentially one of her tenants.
Mm-hmm.
She delivered a refrigerator to the tenant, and while they're chit-chatting, she was asked about the case, and she said something about her opinion of the verdict. And a co-worker of that tenant, this was a Domino's Pizza, a worker at Domino's essentially heard this woman who was on the jury give her opinion, and that got back to the court and SLED, and that was why she was ultimately removed from the jury. Because she discussed the case in public and gave an opinion. This was before Murdoch had, this was before the final arguments and final closing statements and before they had even begun deliberating. That's why she was ultimately, but the whole Facebook thing is way more dramatic and salacious.
And concerning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Jim and Dick say that it appears based on the evidence and the affidavit of the juror and the juror's ex-husband, it would appear that this Facebook post was invented whole cloth and that there was never any evidence that this was actually this woman's husband. It was a mistaken identity case. They can't find the post, it got deleted, quote unquote, from this Facebook group, and they don't know if it was ever actually the person's husband. The actual husband has signed an affidavit saying it wasn't him. The juror has signed an affidavit swearing that's not my husband. Becky had my husband's photo. She knew about my husband's relationship, knew I had a restraining order against him, and this was not my husband. It gets really, it does.
I think, you know, so this goes back, okay, on top of that, of the Facebook post, you have allegations that Ms. Hill went into these jury rooms and said things to the jurors. Don't be fooled by the, right before the Murdoch's defense attorneys got up there. You know, we see the same language in two of the different sworn affidavits that she said that. Tell me, Charlie, can you do that as a clerk of court? That's what I, That's one of my big questions. Mm-hmm. Where did she cross a line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are lots of line crossing here at Ledges, but I think you segue into really the really tough legal question here is what's the standard? Because they've anticipated this in their filing, which I thought was really good advocacy, because the typical, if you look this up, the typical answer is, well, it only makes a difference. You only get a new trial if the result would have been different with the improper communications. However, there are a lot of case law out there that no, when you get into the heart of our legal system, and even if the evidence is overwhelming, as they say, Judge Newman himself said, so it's going to be clear that the state could argue that the result's not going to be different, so whatever Becky Hill did makes no difference. What they focused in on, which I think is correct, is no, we want you to apply the standard that with the jury system, you cannot, even if the proof's overwhelming, you can't allow this to go on. If it's so direct in terms of misconduct and so much of it, you've got to step back and give a person, because the process itself has been tainted so severely, you've got to give somebody a new trial in this situation. And what I thought was effective with this brief was that it wasn't so much like one instance. When you start looking at all of the affidavits and the allegations that they've made with supporting affidavits, it's just so much, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like so this much concerted effort by the clerk to affect the jury verdict that I think that the state's going to have a tough time. I have a lot of respect for Alan Wilson, but he's got a tough role here at this point, doesn't he?
Well, and he has to basically say it's okay if a clerk of court goes in there and says don't be fooled. I mean, how is he going to refute two separate sworn affidavits? And that's where I'm trying to kind of zero in, like, did she, if the allegations are true, mm-hmm, and she said those words, is that, and it is the body, I understand what you're saying about that, but is that wrong?
Well,
and is that wrong to AG
Wilson?
Yeah,
I think the challenge he's got is, I'm assuming they may take the legal position that the standard ought to be, doesn't make a difference in terms of the result, even if these things occur, so therefore the verdict stands. But I would think he would at the same time say, we're going to look into this and get to the bottom of it, hold whoever did this fully accountable. That may be a way to handle this. But it's a challenge from a legal standpoint, because let's say that the state does win. Let's say the Court of Appeals says, no new trial, you've got these affidavits, everything's fine. I just would think they would just leave such a sour taste in everyone's mouth for the rest of really our lives that, wait a minute, did he get a fair trial? Was the result fair here? You know what I'm trying to say? It seems like it does reach to a certain level where this needs to be looked at very carefully.
Well, that go ahead. Would you like to?
Well, my next thing was going to be to tail off of what you just pointed out, Ann. It becomes a question, I think, Charlie, of is it context or semantics, mm-hmm, when we get into the actual accusations. So, and I'll read from one of the affidavits here. This is from juror number 630. She says that Becky Hill told the jury, quote, not to be fooled by evidence from Murdoch's attorneys. And that juror number 630, says she interpreted that to mean that Murdoch would lie. This juror went on to say that Becky Hill told the jury to, quote, watch him closely, look at his actions, and look at his movements before the testimony. And the juror swears that she interpreted that from Becky to mean that Murdoch was guilty. Now, further down, this same juror, mm-hmm, also says that she was ultimately, this is another thing that we're going to foreshadow and get into, this juror says that she was ultimately pressured by other jurors to make a decision, to come to a guilty verdict. She doesn't say it was ultimately Becky's influence that caused her. Mm-hmm. We're getting into jury interference.
Yeah, that's what they're supposed to do, actually. Yeah. I mean, they're supposed to have exchange of ideas and try and convince each other. There's really nothing illegal, improper. It's done every day in jury work. I mean, that's what happens.
But it's in the deliberations.
Yeah, in the deliberating room.
Not during, like, the...
Yeah, not
trial.
For the clerk to, not, exactly, not for the clerk to pressure or pre-deliberations, but in the deliberative process, that is what goes on. Everyone's seen that great movie, right? The what was the name of it? The 12th man, the jury. Yeah, and so that's what, you know. But the
clerk of court, like what Dick and Jim are trying to say, the defense attorneys, they're trying to say that her job is to get food, make sure everybody's comfortable.
True. Yeah, no, I think exactly.
You know, get them to and from the room safely and make sure that they're comfortable. Is there any point where a clerk of court can talk about what's about to happen in the trial.
No, not as they have alleged. But one thing that really occurs to me as we speak, it would seem that it would be in everyone's interest to have an evidentiary hearing, because we're speculating on what this means or that means. Mm-hmm. There seems to be enough here where I would think the Court of Appeals would allow the circuit judge, the trial judge, whoever the trial judge may be, because Judge Newman may be a witness, to have a hearing on all this to see what actually occurred, so we have a full rendition of the facts here, because we are speculating a bit, aren't we?
Well, yeah, and...
Well, I mean, what you just said about Judge Newman being a witness, I can't let that go. Like, really? That did you ever think we would be talking about Judge Clifton Newman, who was remarkable by all standards, would have to come in as a witness on his own?
I know. It's unbelievable, isn't it? But they've got him with the in camera. I remember that in camera hearing, by the way. Yeah. I tried to figure out what went on. They were pretty tight lipped about it.
Yeah. So what we're referencing, if you're not totally familiar, there is a transcript excerpt in the filing from Jim and Dick yesterday that essentially it points back to that Facebook post situation, and. It's alleging that Becky Hill essentially tried to handle the situation and handle it herself before bringing it to Judge Newman. And Judge Newman said on the record that that was concerning to him.
Yeah, he said they were looking for these two, when you were talking about her being a landlord and she was, you know, talking out of turn about, you know, that sort of thing, that's what was being alleged. The court being Judge Newman.
Right.
In this in-camera...
Yeah, now we should explain that. That means they all, just to put it into context, we're all sitting there, and they all rushed back into the judge's chambers, and the court reporter went back there, and we weren't privy to what went on. It was done privately, as can often happen because of the sensitive nature of this issue.
So this is the first time we've heard this as well, because they got a roughed draft of the transcript, because the actual transcripts of the six-week trial have not been completed yet. But we got this, and it says the court, or Judge Newman, says a name, Clifford Dandridge, B Street. Oh, boy. He goes, oh, boy. I'm not too pleased about the clerk interrogating a juror as opposed to coming to me and bringing it to me.
Right.
And Mr. Jim Griffin, defense attorney for Alec Murdoch, says, I was surprised to hear that.
Yes, so that could make him possibly a witness in a full-blown evidentiary hearing.
Right. And when do we get this evidentiary hearing?
Well, the steps are, that's an interesting legal question, because I had to look this up. Under a criminal rule, since it's on appeal, you have to get the permission of the Court of Appeals to have the motion filed in circuit court. And then if the motion's filed, then it's up to that judge who would get that. We don't know who that judge will be. Presumably another judge.
Supreme
to decide,
Court.
No, trial judge, another circuit judge. Okay. Boy, they talk about, I guess Justice Beatty will be looking through his Rolodex as to who the next best Clifton Newman would be.
Who would it be? Oh, well, you can't see it. I would.
There are lots of good choices out there.
Yeah.
So that person would then say, okay, we've got this motion. Do I want to allow further evidence, or we just decide this upon affidavits? I would think they would. The trouble with allowing evidence here, of course, you've got to limit this, because this could go on for like 6 weeks as well, right? Mm-hmm. All the allegations here. But I do think there's some credibility issues. I've got to think the clerk of court's not going to agree to everything that's being alleged against her. But she may have put my hat on representing Becky. You've got some Fifth Amendment concerns that she may want to exercise. She may not want to be speaking either.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Do you want to roll the clip of what Jim and Grove? So the way we found out about this, I'm sure everybody's aware at this point, was that Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin got up, did a press conference in front of the South Carolina Court of Appeals yesterday. And I just want to play a little clip of what Jim said about the new trial. It was that one.
The clerk of court went into the jury room prior to us presenting our case, saying, don't be confused, don't be persuaded when Alec Murdaugh was testifying, don't believe him. And that, I mean, under just every case you can read is enough to give us a new trial. You don't even have to show they listened to it or that it made any difference. That kind of intrusion into the sanctity of the jury room is an automatic new trial. The jury heard 2.5 weeks of the financial fraud before we ever got to the murder trial. And I think it's important to understand that if you look at the forensics, if you look at the government's case, there's no way forensically he could have committed these murders.
But so that was we buttoned two together there. But if you just look at the first part of that clip, if we talk about what they said, they're saying, just based on what you heard, whether or not they listened to him or not, are they right?
Well, as I talked about earlier, there is some case law that the state may well argue that only if it affects the outcome, evidence being so overwhelming. There are some good cases on their side that do say that once you get into this level of misconduct with the jurors and this sort of intrusion into their sanctity, so to speak, that that's enough for a new trial. And so I would be curious as to what the state takes the position on relative to the standard. And whatever their position is, then what the Court of Appeals doesn't have a rule on this. They can just send it back for an evidentiary hearing, but then see what the standard would be at the trial court level. We've got I did read briefly the cases in South Carolina. It doesn't seem to be really clear cut to me. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some openings there that could be exploited by either side. But stepping back from this whole thing, given the tremendous, if this stands, just given the tremendous amount of really improper conduct, I would think that the case for a new trial is pretty strong.
Oh, well, I wanted to just clarify, that clip came from Good Morning America because Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin came on. So we had listened to a press conference earlier, but that came from an interview George Stephanopoulos was doing with Dick and Jim this morning. And to that point, media has played a huge role in not only...
Boy, nice.
Where we get our information on all of this, the way this is rolled out with this book, I mean, you can argue that if Miss Becky had not published
the book.
That's
true. We wouldn't have known about this.
Would we have known about this?
Well, I've got to think, though, just having been around her, that there's got to be another side of the story, right? Wouldn't you think? There's got to be some explanations. This happened, but they misunderstood. It's not as bad as it looks. I just have to think that, particularly in the Facebook business, because that is an allegation of very affirmative, really nefarious conduct.
Well, absolutely. And considering how maybe sometimes our generation deals with Facebook posts in the first place.
Yeah, why not to be aware?
I really want to if somebody told me something about how it was deleted or not deleted. I mean, I could see that getting
confusing.
A little squirrely.
Yeah, and also I'm just trying to put myself in her shoes. You know, there's a lot, 6 weeks, right? And you have lots of contact with the jurors properly. And so maybe she made some offhanded comment that she regrets at this point, and it was just, just highlighted inappropriately out of context here. So we should wait to see. To the point of this trial, we should not rush to judgment with Becky. I mean, she's entitled to deference here.
It was stirring the pot. I mean, that's what happened is when she wrote the book, it stirred the pot and upset these jurors based on what you were reading through, right?
Right. And I'll give I want to give the full context here. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking about giving Becky a fair side in this.
Mm-hmm.
What her book says, now we've already gone over what the allegation is from Murdaugh's side, from the attorneys, from the affidavit of the juror herself, the quote, egg lady. They're alleging that this whole Facebook post by her ex-husband was, again, pulled out of thin air and something sort of foistered by Becky and driven by Becky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Becky actually says in her book is a little different, that everyone pretty much involved with the court, everyone in the trial. So what Becky was saying is that everyone in the trial was sort of aware of this Facebook post on a Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
When the court broke on Friday afternoon, late February, that's when the word started going around the courthouse. from Murdoch's filing, it was almost painted as, no, Becky forced the issue. Becky brought this up. Becky brought this to everyone's attention. Mm-hmm. Her, what she says in her book is that's not the case. Everyone, it was, the rumors were started going mm-hmm. around about it by Friday when court broke. And then she didn't pay much more attention to it and then got asked about it the following Monday morning by mm-hmm. Judge Newman. And then that's when they started going into their, she says, oh yeah, I remember seeing, I remember hearing about it. And then I looked on Facebook on Friday or Saturday night and I saw it and I figured, oh, that must be what they were talking about. And I didn't think any more of it. And until Judge Newman brought it up on that Monday morning. So that's the kind of the mm-hmm. balance to what we're going on here. But as Harpootlian and Griffin pointed out, the timeline doesn't exactly jibe there, because what they're saying is this post
right.
was deleted well before Becky claimed she actually saw it. And that, mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
If it's true. I mean, we have true. To see, as I said, I think we need to wait, you know, totally on this for the response of the state. But having said that, we do have affidavits, right?
Yes.
Sworn statements from jurors.
And I'm going to selfishly do a little tease here about something else that I'm working on.
Ooh, this ought to be good.
Yeah.
Affidavits aren't infallible.
Correct.
And these affidavits, some of them we know, were given... I'll just leave it at that. They aren't infallible, and uh-huh. sometimes affidavits get ruled inadmissible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as they're finding out.
As they do. Look for more on that coming very soon.
Yes.
God, I want to listen to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But going back to what I think an inescapable issue with this, we've talked about what the law says, and mm-hmm. from the angle that Murdoch's attorneys are pursuing here, even if it doesn't rise to that level, what you mentioned early on about misconduct in office. And just, I want to point out some notes that I put on this. Going back to what these juror affidavits said that about the instructions that Becky gave them in the jury room. And what I wrote is, this relies on the jurors' individual interpretations of what she was saying, but does that even matter? Does the context even matter? Because, as we've said, is jury instruction, of jury coaching of any sort, is that under the clerk of court's purview? Like giving them, preparing them for what they're about to experience, like telling them, okay, be careful, watch them closely, even if it was done altruistically, is it even under her?
Or even like saying, oh, those autopsy pictures could be pretty bad.
Yeah, you know, you're getting, you know, this is a national trial, right? International trial. I just would like to think that Becky would have known better than to make any sort of comments like that. So there's got to be another side of this. Again, long trial. Maybe there were some things that were said that that don't rise to improper, but just bad judgment and no criminal intent. And let's wait to hear her side of the story. But having said that, you know, the affidavits, if they turn out to be correct information, I would say at the very least it would be a learning experience for her, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, did she get in trouble as an elected official?
Well, that's another interesting question, because, of course, voters decide who gets to be the clerk of court, and the only way that she could be removed from office would be relative to an actual indictment. We're way away from all that. I don't hate to even mention that. I noticed the defense attorney stayed away from that, which
they
I think is entirely appropriate, because
we're talking about any criminal charges.
Yeah,
that would,
because
arise
it's
from
way
this
early on all that. Yeah, way early on this,
sure.
And she's entitled. I want to give her.
We haven't even heard from her yet.
Exactly, and she. She's not charged with any crime. There's some allegations here of improper contact with the jury, and they're asking, you know, you got to put, you know, look at their motivation, right? I mean, they've lost a trial big time, mm-hmm. the defense attorneys, in record time. And I heard that little clip there that the forensic evidence doesn't support the verdict. I respectfully disagree. I sat there. It fully supports it, my humble opinion. And there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. And so I think, actually, if there's a new trial, I think the result could very well be the same, although I do think the defense would take different tactics. And typically, it benefits the state for a retrial. In this case, it may actually benefit the defense, because I think certain things they did just weren't effective. But having said all that, you know, as I step back from this, maybe take a deep breath and sort of let the process. We're engaged. One thing I will say is that at least there's a process in place here for these allegations, and so the whisper campaign is over with. We have very loud voices screaming out there, and let's let the voices be heard.
Well, the idea of getting a fair new trial, I know that we talked about this before, because everybody, I felt like everybody was talking about Murdoch before he went to trial.
Right.
And we talked about the fact that they just need to find a jury that's willing to listen to the evidence and, you know, make a balanced, fair decision. But now they've heard the evidence. There is no one in South Carolina. Maybe there are some people, but not a lot.
True.
That haven't heard about Murdoch and haven't heard about the kennel video and the, maybe I'm living in my own bubble, but I do believe that the majority of South Carolinians.
Well, would you say under oath that you could decide it based upon the evidence in the courtroom?
That I'd already heard the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
no,
that
you,
I could
you could
to
disabuse your mind of that and listen to the evidence. That's the standard.
I guess so.
I think they'll get people that can do that. Probably maybe half, you know, half the people. I couldn't.
Okay.
I couldn't.
I
think there are some people that maybe didn't follow it as closely, didn't sit there for 6 weeks. And so they'd stand up and would honestly say that I could decide it based upon the evidence I'm now hearing for the next few days or next few weeks.
But it couldn't be in Walterboro.
I think it could.
Really?
And I think the defense will want it there.
Okay.
I don't know. It's up to them. But
I didn't know that. I thought they would be like Greenville.
Well,
I
would assume, just us talking, right? I know South Carolina a little bit. And, you know, the redder the clay, I think the less forgiving perhaps jurors could be. No offense to anyone here locally, because I love lower South Carolina. But I think that area is where they are, is a pretty good little mix of folks for defendant Murdoch. And so I think that's why they wanted it there. So I mean, they're the ones that chose it, right? And remember the pool? There were lots of people that had good contact with the Murdoch family and the law firm and liked them. So I feel like it could be headed back there. It probably a whole different set of court officials, right, that could be involved given the allegations here. But we'll see if it gets that far. We're probably 6 months to a year away from that.
I did get a chance to get on the phone with Alec Murdoch's brother, and
John
Marvin Murdoch, who sat through, I would say almost the entire trial, if not the entire trial. He was sitting straight across from the journalists and the media, and he obviously had the same interactions we all did with Ms. Becky and everything. So I did talk to him today about this, and I want to just read to you what he said to me. He said he was shocked. He was shocked. We all were. It was a bombshell, jaws on the floor when we got this. But he said, I don't know if this is true or not, but if it is, it is absolutely terrible for anybody to have their rights violated for a fair trial. And, you know, that's really the crux of it, is that he was saying, whether or not it's my brother, Alec Murdoch, it is still a terrible thing to think, if it's true, that anyone would try and sway a decision on any level.
I don't think anyone could disagree with that. It sounds like a very statesman-like statement.
One thing I want to go back to, just because I know we're going to get eaten alive by our followers on social media if we don't address it, but some of the discrepancies with the affidavit and the testimony of Juror 785.
Yeah, by the way, was she under oath when she spoke to the judge?
I'm unsure.
I don't think she was. I think it was just a question.
Don't they all take an oath? Don't they all take an oath when they're sworn as jurors? Does that extend to the questioning?
That'd be an interesting legal question. But anyhow, you're right. There's a conflict there, though.
Yes. So it gets into what she says in her sworn affidavit.
Mm-hmm.
She, like the other two jurors, mentions several instances of Becky Hill essentially talking to the jury, and giving them instructions, coaching them as it appears on what evidence to believe and what not to believe and how to interpret what they're seeing. And she says she, like the other jurors, mentions other instances throughout trial when it happened. there's even a reference to when they all went out to visit Moselle. Mm-hmm. No, I may be mm-hmm. wrong on that. I may be wrong on that from this particular juror. I don't want to. I'm confusing that with the other juror affidavits. I don't think she specifically mentioned the visit to Yes, she did. Okay, I'm right. She says when they all went to Moselle, she saw Becky walking with the foreperson of the jury, and that's a theme throughout all of this. That the three juror affidavits they have, they describe private conversations between the foreperson of the jury and Becky. And none of the contents of those conversations, none of them were made privy to. And when asked about them, we're told that it couldn't be discussed with them. That's just more depth into what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it goes to this. When the juror 785 was called before Judge Newman to discuss the incident with the Domino's employee and whether she was discussing the case outside of court like she shouldn't have been, which she denies in these new sworn affidavits. She denies that she ever said anything about the case or discussed the case outside of the court, outside of the jury. But when she was called in front of Judge Newman, the official transcript specifically mentions Judge Newman asking Juror 785, Egg Lady, if Becky Hill had ever discussed the case with any of the jurors. And in front of Judge Newman during the trial, Juror 785 said no, that never happened. Yet here in this sworn affidavit, she says it happened on multiple occasions. So we already have a discrepancy. Again, and I pointed to, there appears to be somewhat of a discrepancy on the timeline of the Facebook post. So back to the little tease I gave earlier, these affidavits aren't infallible. There might not, I don't mean to suggest nefarious intent. Maybe she remembered better. Maybe she misremembered. Who knows? We're going to get to the bottom of that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But the affidavits aren't infallible, and the jurors' memories aren't infallible. And it does somewhat seem convenient now, after the attorneys spent all summer chasing this, that they finally got what they were after. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where
something
we...
That's a great point, a valid point, too.
Something
point.
To think about.
It is.
And, you know, we're gonna be absolutely... there's no way we're not going to hear a lot more about this because we've got 10 days before the AG's got to come back mm-hmm. and answer this, right?
Yeah.
We haven't heard from Becky Hill yet. We certainly want to. We want to hear from the jurors as well. We're hoping that, you know, one thing that we did hear was that if this goes to an evidentiary hearing, there's a very good chance that these jurors are going to have to...
Wow, you imagine being one of the jurors right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, they're going to have to go up and have their own sworn affidavits. So they're going to have to do their own sworn testimony for this hearing.
Possibly, yes.
I think I guess they... Can they even say the fifth at this point? Can they do that?
Well, I don't think they would have a... I don't think they would be involved with anything that should allow would make them think they would want to take the fifth.
I think the more themselves, yeah.
I think the more important question or possible question would be the trial judge hearing this. How far does he want to let this go with complete jury interrogation? Do you want to limit it to certain things, or I've heard enough where I will do? I don't know. That's just thinking through this. You could actually have like a month long trial on this stuff, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And I don't know if a judge would want to necessarily sign up for something like that. He'd probably want to limit it somehow. Yeah, and also, you know,
he's already got an extremely busy general sessions calendar that he's
trying
to
keep up with. So the AG is going to play a critical role in how this gets resolved, I believe, position.
Sorry, Charlie. One more thing that I wanted to address with that, which kind of dovetails with what you were just mentioning. What, if anything, comes of the accusations that the jury was ignoring Judge Newman's specific orders not to discuss the case with each other or with anyone else? Because what's another common thread in these affidavits is that there was discussion of the case among the jurors going on when you all saw this for yourselves. Do not discuss the case. Do not discuss the case. You may bring the jury. How many times did we hear those refrains from Judge Newman? Do not discuss the case.
Yeah.
And they're saying it happened
often. Yeah. Well, let me make sort of a general, not about this trial, right, just sort of in general, but just among people who do a lot of trial work, the idea that human beings, jurors, don't go home and have any discussion whatsoever about the case. I think most people accept that we're all fallible human beings, that it's really just, wouldn't you say near impossible, not to have at least a little, sorry, honey, I can't talk about this, but kind of thing. And so I think the standard here would, yeah, right, you'd have to decompress from seeing those pictures, for example.
Right, of course.
I do think, though, that the if there's added to the fuel here, so to speak, if you can prove that there's lots of discussion pre-verdict, and there's, remember this business about Becky going into allegation to a private room with the jury foreperson? And by the way, correct my memory, but as I recall, the jury elected a different person, and we ended up with another person. I guess there's a story to that.
There was a gentleman that was supposed to be the
He was elected by the jurors, and they asked wasn't he the foreperson. The judge said, I'm picking this person. So I don't know whether that person was recommended by somebody to the trial judge to be. I'm just asking.
All of that's going to be questioned.
Yeah, and so there's just a lot to unpack here, isn't there?
I believe I read it was recommended by the court. But does that mean recommended by Judge Newman, or does that mean recommended by Becky? Because the context of that phrasing was, there was in one of the affidavits, it said it made a point of, it made a note of that, oh, by the way, this foreperson that was constantly allegedly talking to Becky privately and then not sharing the with the rest of the jury, that was not the foreperson that the jury had chosen for itself. And then, but it phrased it as, and I think this was Jim and Dick's filing phrased it this way, that foreperson was chosen by the court.
Right. Yeah. Well, and is that illegal to like go and talk privately with the foreperson for the
That would not be proper. Oh. Yeah, these are private conversations. You know, it'd be one thing if you're talking about, hey, what's for lunch type thing, but the affidavit clearly paints the picture that she's friendly, right, with the foreperson, and they had a plan.
And then, what purpose did the bailiff serve, if that was going on? That's what the bailiff's role is. He's relaying messages to the clerk.
So there's just a lot of things here to kind of go through here.
Well, we're going to keep on working on it. We're going to be hearing the answers in the next 10 days. We also have more podcasts coming up for you. We have a whole roster of other trials.
Unlimited with the Murdoch case, right? Instead of like
pleadings going on and
sentencings and
status conferences. Yeah. You've seen us on the air. We're going to keep you in touch with what's happening. And Charlie, thank you so much for coming
today.
My
pleasure. Good to be with y'all. The reunion
Drew,
here.
Fantastic to hear all of the insight that you're bringing into our story. This is a great opportunity to go back and listen to some of those podcasts that we had. I did notice that was actually what they ended up using for the filing was the ABC News 4 YouTube. We obviously had the best coverage, so you know where I'm going with this. But go back, Unsolved South Carolina, the murder, money, and mystery. It's a great opportunity to kind of get back up to speed because you never know if there's another new trial around the corner.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to say, and I mentioned this on my personal social media, is for full disclosure, for transparency, we touched on it at the beginning, but we are all friendly with Becky Hill. We had spent a lot of time with her. I've known my working relationship predates the Murdoch trial, other trials in Colleton County. I like Becky. It's been a very friendly and cordial and good working relationship. And we have thanked them and praised them on our podcast before. The people of Walterboro, the clerk, the clerk's office, the court. But when you have serious allegations, that's the double-edged sword of what we do. Mm-hmm. We're there for the bad. We're there for the good. And these allegations are bad. And we're going to treat them fairly and respectfully and pursue them till the end and see
that's a good point because, you know, here we have Defendant Murdoch who was presumed innocent right under the law for these heinous crimes.
Right.
Well, at the very least, we have to give deference to Becky that she is presumed not to have done any of this because these are mere allegations. But you do point out they're serious and they're under oath.
Yes. Yep. So we're going to treat them seriously.
So stay tuned. We'll try and get to the bottom of it.